Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode 402. This week on the program, we've got a couple great pieces, including one on the unsung hero of Joseph Warren. Now, I say unsung, that's because he just doesn't get as much play as good old George Washington. So I want to talk about Joseph Warren in this episode and kind of the incredible BA guy he was. Aside from that, we've got a piece on the Worshipful Master's hat and some news, so stick around. But we'll go ahead and get right into the education this week right after this. Now comes the point in the show where I ask you to help support this show. How do we do that? Well, we have a bunch of different ways to do that today. If you head on over to WCYpodcast.com, you can click on direct donation through PayPal, which we briefly touched on in the beginning of the program. Of course, you can make that one-time donation, or you can sign up to be a monthly contributor. Contributing $2 a month, $5, or even $10 a month, whatever you choose, really helps the program out. Of course, we have a limited edition shop where you can pick up any number of items that come direct from us. Help us out by going to MasonicRevival.com, but also we have some other affiliates that are really important. Bankers Best, one of the most unique things we've ever done, is to work with Brother Levi Banker out of St. Louis, who owns his own company called Bankers Best Beard and Skincare. He's been so generous. If you head to WCYpodcast.com, click on More, then click on Bankers Best, and you can check out a bunch of the different products he's got. He's got a whole line of beard care products, skincare, oils, balms, all of this stuff, and he has been doing it a long time. He knows a lot about it. Everything is handmade, quality items. We even came up with the King Solomon's Reserve Beard Balm, which is a few years old now, but remains one of the great products that he still offers. Even the artwork on the bottle was done by a brother. The nice thing about this particular product is 50% of the proceeds come back to the program. If you're a history guy like me, then you'll be pleased to know that what makes the beard oil and balm very special is that it was made utilizing the fragrances specific to the exports of King Solomon's time and location, which is amazing. So black fig and honey is the formula. Luxurious scent, as Levi says, truly fit for our first Grand Master. If you use the promo code BBWCY357 at checkout, you'll also get a little bit of a percentage off. Please check that out. Bankers Best, or just head on over to buybankersbest.com. We also have a code with On It. You can go to our website, click on More, then go to On It, and you can click through any of the links here, or just go to onit.com and use the promo code WCY at checkout. You'll get 10% off, and they'll send a little bit back to the program to help us out. And of course, it's business time. The book that I wrote with John T. Ruark, it is making some real waves, and people are using it and seeing success. So check that out on Amazon. You can click right to it. You can get it on Audible, Kindle, or in print, even on iBooks. And last but not least, I want to ask you to check out the Great Books program. You'll see the banner for it on the left-hand side, Intellectual Linear Progression. Use the promo code WCY, or you can just click on that link there, and you'll actually go right to the website and hear a little bit from Scott Hambrick about how awesome the program is. So that's it. I hope you guys enjoy, and thank you so much for helping us out. Just a quick couple additions to that. Head on over to WCYpodcast.com, hover over More, click on Franklin's Fortune to check out this great, awesome card game made by a brother for the world at large. And it's fantastic, super fun. I've said it before, I'll say it again, it gets my kids off of Fortnite. And recently there's been a retrograde back to Minecraft, which is interesting. So it gets them off of Minecraft too. But check that out. Use the coupon code WCY to get $5 off your order. And last but not least, I want to tell you that the week for open enrollment for the Great Books program is happening right around the corner. At the time of recording this, July 4th, enrollment opens in 3 days, 13 hours, 30 minutes. So actually, by the time this comes out, it will be Monday morning, the 8th, and open enrollment is open. So go to onlinegreatbooks.com, use your promo code WCY, and you're going to get a substantial amount taken off your first enrollment. So check that out.
I highly encourage it. If you're looking for more actual academic approach to understanding texts, which is super important with ritual work and other things, then you need to go and check out this program if you're serious about actually diving into something and not just talking. I guess that's the nicest way I can put that. So check it out, onlinegreatbooks.com. We've got all the information on WCYpodcast.com. So the first piece this week is The Master's Hat, September 1934, by Unknown. Why does the Master wear a hat? How many times do newly raised brethren ask the question, and how few of the brethren interrogated can give a satisfactory answer? Usually the reply is, oh, that's an old symbol, or that's one of the landmarks. But as a matter of fact, wearing a hat in lodge is symbolically only, as all custom with regard to headgear are symbolic, and certainly no custom which has suffered so many changes and reversals as this can by any stretch of a point be considered a landmark. Ceremonies connected with clothing are very ancient, dating at least from the era in which the first captives in tribal wars were stripped of all their clothing, partly that their captors might possess it, partly as a symbol of the complete subjugation of the slave state. Among some peoples today, stripping part of the clothing is still a sign of respect. The Tahitians uncover the waist as a sign of reverence to a king. Asiatics bare the feet. Japanese take off a slipper for ceremonious salute. Worshippers in ancient Greece and Rome remove their sandals in house of worship, as do East Indians today. During the days of chivalry, knights often wore full armor in public and usually when going upon private journeys. To open a visor was a form of greeting which said, in effect, I do not expect a sword thrust in the mouth from you. A knight removed his helmet before a friend as a token that he feared no blow, and always in the presence of a king, as a symbol that his life was the king's. Moderns remove the hat as a sign of respect in greeting a friend, always when speaking to or meeting a lady, a survival of the ancient custom of uncovering as a symbol of trust or subjectivity to a higher authority. That monarchs wear crowns or hats as a rite when all others are uncovered has been sung by poets of all ages. In Scott's Lady of the Lake, Ellen Douglas is taken to see the king, little suspect who is he. Quote, on many a splendid garb she gazed, then turned bewildered and amazed. For all stood bare, and in the room, Fitz James alone wore a cap and plume. To him each lady's look was lent, on him each courtier's eye was bent. Midst furs and silks and jewels sheen, he stood in simple Lincoln green, the center of the glittering ring, and Snowdon's knight is Scotland's king. End quote. The king never uncovered. He wore his crown where he would, even in the house of God. All had to uncover before the king, as all had to retreat from his presence by moving backward, a custom which obtains even today in ceremonial audiences in England, that none might turn his back on the sovereign. The very bowing of the head in the presence of authority confessed either fearlessness of an unseen blow, or his willingness to receive it from the liege lord. Not always does the removal of a hat indicate respect. Orthodox Jews remain covered in their synagogues. Early Quakers wore hats in their houses of worship. Women do not remove their hats in some churches. Romans prayed with covered heads. Indeed, Romans forbade the head covering to a slave, a wooden cap, pileus, being only for citizens. After a Roman owner liberated a slave, the manumitted man often went to the temple of Feronia on Mount Sarect, if indeed he did not receive his freedom in her temple. Feronia, the goddess of fruits, nurseries, and groves, was especially honored as the patron of enfranchised slaves, and in her temple, the manumitted received the cap. Dr. George C. Williamson, Curious Survivals, says of the House of Commons in London, quote, a member has to wear his hat when he is to address the House, and there is often confusion when the member is unable to find his hat at the moment and put it on before he addresses the Speaker. But were he to rise without his hat, he would be greeted immediately with cries of, order, order! Just when or where originated the custom of a master wearing a hat as a sign of authority is an unsolved question. It is easily enough to guess that it began from operative masons of the Middle Ages aspiring to the customs of the court and requiring all fellows of the craft to uncover before the master mason, but guessing is not proving. Oliver is quoted as saying, quote, among the Romans, the hat was a sign of freedom. Formerly, masons wore them as a symbol of freedom and brotherly equality. In English and American lodges, it is now exclusively an attribute of the master's costume, end quote. Oliver, as a historian, is open to question. Certainly, hats are not generally worn by masters in England now, but this quotation indicates that English masters formerly did, which is borne out by some notable expressions of today. Bristol, for instance, and Lodge Newstead, 47, in the province of Nottingham, where the master wears a silk hat at lodge ceremonials. In the Royal Sussex Lodge of Hospitality in Bristol, the master carries, not wears, a cocked hat into the room. In Lodge Moria, the transfer of the hat from outgoing to incoming master has, for many years, been a part of the installation. There are extant some rituals of French masonry of 1787, apparently authentic, which seem to give a true picture of the ritual and practices of French brethren of the time. Masonic students are agreed that while doubtless French masons did dramatize some of the English ritual and made certain changes in the old English ceremonies, which better fitted the Latin temperament, on the whole, these rituals contain much that was originally English Masonic practice. In the old French ritual of 1787, in the third degree, each master is required to wear a hat. The word master here has a double significance, master of the lodge and master mason. This has led to some confusion in translating in the real meaning of the ritual. But in this particular instance, the context is made clear by some old prints showing French brethren in a lodge in which all present wear hats except the candidate. Writing in 1896, worshipful brother Goldfuth Grenier states of German Masons, quote, "It is the invariable custom for brethren in lodge to wear silk hats, which are raised during prayer and when the name of the grand architect of the universe is invoked. In that country, it, the wearing of the hat, is not a distinction confined to those of any particular standing." It is to be noted that the Ahiman Raison of Pennsylvania specifies that at Masonic funerals, all the brethren should wear black hats. Contrast these instances of all brethren wearing hats except the candidate with one of the articles of the statutes of the chapter of Clermont, 1755, which reads, quote, "Only the master of a lodge and the Scots masters are permitted to remain covered." Confirming this, an old 18th century catch question which survives in some of our lodges to this day is, question, where does the master hang his hat? Answer, on nature's peg. Some fanciful theories have been advanced to account for the master's hat. Among these may be mentioned this curious idea, because of a supposed unpopularity of the mason's craft in the Middle Ages, the brethren on a cathedral building project were occasionally permitted to hold their meetings in the cathedral they built, or, if it was not sufficiently advanced, in a nearby monastery. The monks, being learned men, were often made masters of the various builders' lodges and continued to wear their mitres, as was their custom. From this is supposed to have arisen the custom of a master wearing a hat. Fort, in his Antiquities of Freemasonry, writes, quote, "During the Middle Ages, when traveling fellow approached a lodge of masons in a prescribed form, he first exclaimed, 'May God bless, direct, and prosper you, master, paleer, wardens, and dear fellows.' Whereupon the master, or his absence of the paleer, was instructed by the ordinance of Torgau to thank him in reply, in order that the visiting brother might see who was the custodian of the lodge. And having obtained suitable assistance, the wandering craftsman removed his hat and thanked the brethren with an established formula. From the preceding ceremony, it is evident that neither the master nor the wardens of a medieval German lodge were distinguishable by distinctive tokens while at mechanical labor. Otherwise, no regulation was essential or obligatory upon the officers to make proper response to a visitor for the purpose of determining the master. Curiously enough, the implication is direct and clear that the masons of ancient times, when regularly convened for work, and during the formal reception of a traveler, pursued their daily avocation and attended the usual Masonic demands, within closed portals, with covered heads. At the present day, the custom has materially changed, and with one exception, the members of a lodge at labor noticeably divest themselves of their hats. This is unquestionably a transformation of recent origin, and, with it, the instruction usually incident to the distinction has been adopted to the innovation. When the initiatory rites in a medieval lodge were performed, the master was not thus prominently contrasted with his brethren. I speak with a special emphasis upon this point because the esoteric and sublime signification involved in the master's hat has been recklessly perverted and destroyed. It was typical during the Middle Ages of superiority and was so interpreted in the ceremonies of initiation by the Masons of France at the termination of the 18th century, all of whom sat in open lodge with covered heads. At the conclusion of the rites in French lodges, the master handed the candidate his hat and said, quote, for the future you shall be covered in a master's lodge. End quote. This very ancient usage is a sign of liberty and superiority. Among the Germans, this article was used as a symbol of transfer of chattels and landed property. The judge held a hat in his hands. The purchaser must receive it from him, and with it, the title passed. Frequently, the ceremony perfecting a sale was performed by the contract parties thrusting their hands into a hat, and upon withdrawing them, the estate changed owners. Gothic justices wore a cap or suitable headdress when presiding over court, as emblematic of authority, and manifestly the people wore their hats while attending the tribunal as symbols of personal liberty. In an engraving dating from the 15th century given in La Croix, OP, citation page 379, all persons attendant upon the court are presented with heads covered, and with this typical illusion generally acquiescence originally harmonized. But the distinctive and exceptional feature of a master's headdress contained the secret symbolism of authority at the present day, while medieval masons worked with covered heads as a sign of freedom. Both customs descended from a remote Teutonic antiquity have long since dissipated their vital forces, while the ordinary interpretation possesses less significance than a dilapidated milepost. By all of which it may be seen that we really know very little, and must guess a great deal as to the origin of the custom. But in the light of history and the etiquette of various ages, the most probable theory seems to be that a master wears a hat today in imitation of the rulers of olden times, who wore a hat or a crown while those whom them allegiance were uncovered. Turning from history to practice, a question often asked is, when should the worshipful master remove his hat? The answer must come from taste rather than law. Some masters are veritable hat snatchers, pulling off their headgear whenever they speak from the east. There seems little more reason for a master to divest himself of his badge of office when addressing a brother than to remove his apron or jewel. The master's hat is not used as a head covering designed for warmth and protection from the wearer, but as a badge of authority. Good taste would dictate its lifting when a master speaks of or to deity, of death, during the reading of a passage of scripture, and in the presence of the Grand Master. In other words, the master's hat is doffed in the presence of superior authority. What kind of hat should a master wear? Here also is neither law nor rule except for those of good taste. Fashion and custom rule all our clothing, including our hats. The gentleman in a dark cutaway coat, gray striped trousers, a black and white tie, gray gloves, and spats, who appeared at the White House wearing a golf cap, might easily be mistaken for a lunatic. He who tried to step to bat on the diamond with a derby would certainly receive Bronx cheers, if not pop bottles. Lodges in which the officers appear in evening clothes, either swallowtails or dinner coats, naturally expect masters to use black silk hats. Lodges where less formality is practiced frequently see masters in silk hats, but the results are sometimes anomalous. The spectacle of a brother in white trousers, black and white shoes, and a silk hat is incongruous at the least. At a lodge meeting in hot weather, informal clothes, the master is better dressed with a straw hat than the more formal silk. Lodges in which officers wear ordinary business clothes should look with approbation on the felt or derby. The Grand Master in Massachusetts wears a three-cornered cockade hat at the solemn ceremonies of St. John's Day in winter, survival of the custom begun in the days of when Paul Revere was Grand Master in that jurisdiction, inclusive of a large, heavily gold-encrusted apron, collar, gauntlets, and jewels, removes any feeling of incongruity from the appearance of this old custom. The Massachusetts Grand Master does not wear his cockade hat when visiting other Grand Lodges. That the Grand Master should wear his hat and not let the old custom go by default merely for personal convenience goes without saying, but it has been said. On closing the 150th communication of the Grand Lodge of New York, Grand Master Charles S. Johnson, now Grand Secretary, said, quote, I want to call your attention to the fact that I have been wearing a hat during this communication. I have done it on purpose, not because I have any desire to wear a hat like this, but I want you men in the lodge to see that the ancient custom of a master wearing a hat shall not be dispensed with. I have found, as I have gone around the state again and again, that in many lodges there is no attempt on the part of the master to fulfill this ancient tradition of our fraternity. It is a very interesting tradition in our organization, and I think it is one that we ought not to lose, and therefore I have set you the example, and I ask you in your respective lodges throughout the state and the city of New York to see that this old tradition, which has been so honored in the past, shall continue even in these modern days." End quote. Now there you have this very interesting piece on the master's hat. I love the piece. I love talking about the objective research that's gone into historical accounts of why people wore hats or coverings and crowns and specifically, you know, closing of real estate deals and things. Very interesting customs indeed. I've been to some lodges where they don't actually do silk hats. They do these felt crown things that are really interesting. Supposedly they are reminiscent of a mock crown of King Solomon. And in many other jurisdictions, including here in Illinois, the master's hat is supposed to be like black with a brim. But also it says to wear a hat is the master's discretion. So that's also interesting, not required. And now, being the 4th of July, I would like to read you this piece on the Martyr of Bunker Hill, Joseph Warren, by Robert W. Williams III. Now, it doesn't say when this was written, but we could probably figure it out by doing the math in the first opening paragraph of this piece. Now, before I start this, I want to say that my love affair with Joseph Warren began when Brother Mike Jarzabek, Right Worshipful Brother Mike Jarzabek, actually told me about him and pointed out a wonderful book that was just recently accomplished, and I'll talk about that after the piece. So let's check out this piece here, Joseph Warren, Martyr of Bunker Hill, in honor of this 4th of July. On a quiet summer afternoon, about 230 years ago, some Harvard College students shut themselves in an upper dormitory room to arrange some affairs pertaining to their class. Another class member desired to be with them. Knowingly, they intended to thwart some fondly cherished purpose of his own. They refused to admit him. The door was closed, and he could not gain admittance without violence, which he chose to avoid. Reconnoitering the premises, he discovered that one of the windows in the room was open, and he noticed a nearby waterspout that extended from the roof to the ground. He climbed to the top of the house and slid down the eaves, then laid hold of the spout and descended until he was opposite the open window. With a prodigious physical effort, he thrust himself through the window and landed in the room. Simultaneously, the waterspout crashed to the ground. Had it fallen a moment sooner, he would have been thrown to the pavement below and undoubtedly seriously injured. He coolly remarked to himself, "It served its purpose." That Harvard boy was Joseph Warren, and later known as Dr. Warren and General Warren, the Martyr of Bunker Hill, and the Grand Master of Masons, Massachusetts Provincial Grand Lodge in North America. The boy had already given promise to the man in whatever he undertook. The fearless act of getting to that room was the swelling bud which opened and blossomed and bore fruit in his adult life. In December of 1769, Warren received a commission from the Earl of Deloise, Grand Master of Masons in Scotland, appointing him Provincial Grand Master of Masons in Boston and within 100 miles of the same. The commission was dated May 30, 1769. When the Earl of Dumfries succeeded Deloise as Grand Master, he issued another appointment to Warren, dated March 7, 1772, constituting him Grand Master of Masons for the continent of America. Extending his original limits, he was indefatigable in the discharge of his Masonic duties, coupled with his extensive medical practice, the care of his motherless children, together with his patriotic devotion to his country, won for him the highest regard of the public and the craft. Now, I'd like to break into the paper for just a moment. I used a word, indefatigable, and that word in particular is very antiquated. In fact, I didn't even know what it meant. So, for the benefit of the listener, let's just define that very quickly. It's an adjective and it means persisting tirelessly. So, back to the paper. His name is indelibly engraved on the mystic temples of Freemasonry, just as it is on the pages of American history. Somewhat impetuous in nature, but brave to a fault, Brother Warren craved the task of doing what others dared not to, the same courage imbued in Paul Revere and other patriots. On the anniversary of the Boston Massacre, March 3, 1770, Warren was the orator. While it was a duty which won him distinction, it was also one of peril. English military officers attended in order to heckle Warren, and it required a brave man to stand up in Old South Church in the face of those officers to boldly proclaim their bloody deeds. It required a cool head and steady nerves, and Grandmaster Warren had both. The crowd at the church was immense. The aisles, the pulpit stairs, and the pulpit itself were filled with officers and soldiers of the garrison, gathered there to intimidate the speaker. Warren was equal to the task, but entered the church through a pulpit window in the rear, knowing he might have been barred from entering through the front door. In the midst of his most impassioned speech, an English officer seated on the pulpit stairs and in full view of Warren held several pistol bullets in an open hand. The act was significant. While the moment was one of peril and required the exercise of both courage and prudence, to falter and allow a single nerve or muscle to tremble would have meant failure, even ruin, to Warren and others. Everybody knew the intent of the officer, and a man of less courage than Warren might have flinched, but the future hero, his eyes having caught the act of the officer, and without the least discomposure or pause in his discourse, simply approached the officer and dropped a white handkerchief onto the officer's hand. The act was so adroitly and courteously performed that the Breton was compelled to acknowledge it by permitting the orator to continue in peace. On June 14, 1775, 3 days before the Battle of Bunker Hill, actually Breed's Hill, Dr. Warren was elected Major General by the Provincial Congress of Massachusetts. Without military education or experience, he was placed in the presence of the whole British Army, against the protests of General Artemas Ward, General Israel Putnam, and others. Warren chose to shoulder a musket and join the fighting men behind the barricades on the hill. He felt a premonition of his death, and declared to Betsy Palmer, whose husband joined the Tea Party and the Battle of Lexington, quote, "Come, my little girl, drink a glass of wine with me for the last time, for I shall go to the hill tomorrow, and I shall never come off," end quote. The shooting lasted less than 1 hour, but only because the Patriots ran out of ammunition. Warren had been shot in the back of the head and thrown to the ground. His body was thrown in a ditch by a British officer and buried with the others. It was discovered months later and identified by Paul Revere, who recognized a false tooth he had made for Warren. He was next buried in the Granary Burial Ground, Tremont Street, Boston, where he was laid after Masonic ceremonies in King's Chapel, and thirdly in the Warren Tomb in St. Paul's Cathedral, Boston. Finally, on August 3, 1855, quote, "The precious ashes were carefully deposited in an imperishable urn and placed in the family vault at Forest Hill Cemetery, where they now repose," end quote. Grand Lodge Proceedings, 1855 through 1869, page 511. On April 8, 1777, Congress ordered a monument to be erected over the grave of General Warren in his town of Boston. But, like many other things, Congress resolves it was never accomplished. In 1794, King Solomon's Lodge of Charleston, now meeting in Somersville, erected a monument on Bunker Hill, on land donated by Brother Benjamin Russell for that purpose. It was a Tuscan pillar, 18 feet in height, placed on a platform 8 feet high, 8 feet square, and fences around. The Bunker Hill Monument Association was formed in 1823 for the purpose of erecting on Bunker Hill a more fitting and enduring monument to the memory of the brave men who fell there in the cause of human liberty. King Solomon's Lodge, 1783, then gave the association the ground which it owned, together with the monument it had erected to the memory of Brother Warren, on condition that some trace of its former existence might be preserved in the monument to be erected. On June 17, 1825, Grand Lodge opened at 8 a.m., and a procession was formed on the common which marched to Bunker Hill in Charlestown. There, in the presence of Brother Lafayette, the apron he wore in the Grand Lodge archives, representatives from 5 New England states, along with the Grand Lodge of New Jersey, Grand Master John Abbott and Senior Past Grand Master Isaiah Thomas, assisted in laying the cornerstone, and Lafayette and Brother Daniel Webster addressed the great gathering. The monument was completed and dedicated on June 17, 1843, but without the presence of the Grand Lodge. It was during the anti-Masonic era, and the resolution to attend was defeated. Inside the present obelisk is a model of the first monument that had been erected by King Solomon's Lodge. It is made of the finest Italian marble, and including the granite pedestal on which it stands is about 9 feet in height and bears substantially the same inscription as the former one. The memorial is now under the jurisdiction of the National Park Services, 1976, and anybody can climb the 294 steps to the top without charge. From windows, you can view Boston, and in particular Charlestown, Navy Yard, where the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides, is berthed. Contributing source, Cornelius Moore, in The Voice of Masonry, published in the Freemason Repository, November 1881, Volume 11, Short Talk Bulletin, Number 91, July. This Short Talk Bulletin on Joseph Warren was written by Robert W. Williams III, a Massachusetts Freemason who served as editor of the Trowell publication of the Grand Lodge of Massachusetts for many years. This article was also reprinted by the Southern California Research Lodge. Now, at the beginning of this, before I started, I said I would tell you about the best Joseph Warren book there is. And the best Joseph Warren book there isn't some massive tome. It's actually about, just less than a half inch thick. It comes in at about 120 pages. It's square-shaped, say 9 by 10 inches. And on the cover is an eloquent portrait that was commissioned by the author of Warren at the Battle of Bunker Hill. He's posed for battle, drawing swords because they're out of ammunition and preparing for a final charge. And he's just ready to get in there. And the book is by Brother Shane A. Newell. I actually own a first edition here, and it's signed by Shane Newell. Book is dedicated to friends, fellow collectors. He's got a significant, nice acknowledgement in there for his wife. But the book is published, and it has such great information on Warren, great artwork on every page, and wonderfully written. I would very much suggest picking up a copy of the book if you can find it. It's called Joseph Warren and the Boston Rebellion by Newell, N-E-W-E-L-L. I'll try to put a link in the show notes because I find that it is a rather wonderful text, and I think everybody should get a chance to read it. There's a lot of people who say that had he survived, Joseph Warren would have been our first president other than Washington, much more renowned at the time than Washington even. Maybe blasphemous to say. Both brothers, however, Joseph Warren had what some people would consider a better reputation than Washington at that time. And had he survived, would have succeeded in becoming America's first president, still a Mason. But pretty interesting stuff. And being able to read about Joseph Warren on this 4th of July means a little bit something special for me. Nothing out of the ordinary. It just feels right. So I hope everybody had a wonderful 4th of July. I hope you kept all your fingers, and you didn't blow anything off, and you didn't get in trouble, you didn't start any wildfires. So again, hope you all had a wonderful 4th of July. We'll talk to you all next week. Likely, we're going to pre-record an episode so that it is out on time, because I don't get home until 11 o'clock Sunday night after the South Pasadena Masonic Lodge, MasonicCon. So we're going to record this episode probably in the next day or two and schedule it to come out next week. But I hope you enjoyed this one. Until next time, for Vince Camu and Robert Johnson, take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.